Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. Today is a bit of a teaser episode. Next week I'm going to be talking to Sarah Jane Barnett about Anne Kennedy's The Time of the Giants. But we had so much fun last night at Sarah Jane's launch for her new book of poetry work. It's her second book of poetry, and I just thought we can't wait to put it up. So what I've got is a little show here with excerpts from the launch, and I also recorded the rehearsal of the Sarah organised this amazing reading with her, Matt Bialystocki, and Therese Lloyd. So they read from the book, and it was magnificent. So that's in there as well. I also talked to a couple of people about Sarah's work, and yeah, and roll on next week. The podcast with our talk should be up by next Saturday, which is around about the 30th or the 31st. It'll be just in time for Halloween. Ooh. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it, and yeah, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Tom Conroy. So you want me to talk a little bit about Sarah Jane Barnett's work?
That'd be great, yeah.
Yeah. Examined her PhD and just really loved her work there, really stood out. What I really liked about it was the way that it just pushed up against the boundaries of fiction, even though it's poetry, and the way that it just questioned what it was doing at every turn, and the way that the cadence would fool me into thinking that it was a poem, and then suddenly we'd be into prose, and then we'd use that power, we'd switch gears and use that power of poetry again, and I just really thought it was lyrical and beautiful and just doing new things. So yeah,
Matt Bialystocki. I've been watching a poetry developer 3 or 4 years now, and most of it started a long time before that. So all of the poems in this particular collection, the really long form ones, are pretty well gestated. A lot of time and thought has gone into them, and it comes across when you read them.
Awesome. And tonight you're going to be helping with the reading, eh?
Yeah.
What's that like, being part of a sort of like dual reading like that?
It's good for me. But I don't mind speaking in front of people, so it's all good. I do like to pretty much have any opportunity to engage with poetry beyond just reading it. So reading out with other people, to other people, is just another way. It's very different to reading it by yourself. Or
Brian Walpert. Well, Sarah's poetry is unique in a couple of ways. One way is it's experiment with prose, and it's experiment with fictional techniques of character and even plot. So she's constantly moving between the beautiful perceptual lyric moments and the perceptual lyric sentences to larger issues of character. That's one thing. A second thing is her great interest in structure. She's a real poet of architecture, so that different parts of the poem speak to one another really quite beautifully.
Therese Lloyd. So what I'm really impressed about with Sarah's book is that it's really robust. It's a really dense, beautiful book. She's got this amazing way of, like Hini Moana was saying in the speech tonight, she's got this amazing way of writing the body, which makes you feel like you're absolutely inhabiting it. And I don't know, it's something that Sarah is, it's a gift that she has. The other thing that I really like about this book is that Sarah's one of the most, you know, she sets out to do something and she absolutely does it with gusto. She does it with such integrity and such hard work. And when I think about things like, when we did the MA program together years ago, and she did the same, she had that same process then, like she just has this idea in her mind and she just works and works until she's personally happy with it, you know, like it's just something that I really admire, and you feel that when you read this book. It's just, it's full of integrity and it's choice.
And tonight you helped read the poem. What's that like reading someone else's work in that particular way?
Man, it's such a privilege. Like, it's a real privilege. Like, when Sarah asked me if I wanted to do this like ages ago, ago, because she's very organized, I said, yeah, man, I'd be totally honored to do that. And because it's like you get a really different feel for it. Because when you read another person's poems, I don't tend to read them out loud to myself. Sometimes I do, but most of the time I don't. And I certainly don't read other people's poems in front of a big group of people, you know? So that was a really, really cool experience. But also, because she had me reading just one small excerpt out of the poem Ghosts, as the character Diane, like, I got to start feeling this character, you know? Just, it was a really, really cool experience, actually. So I'm really stoked that she asked me to do it.
Kia ora koutou katoa. My name is Rachel O'Neill, and I'm going to say a few words tonight on behalf of Hue & Cry publisher Chloe Lane, who unfortunately can't be here tonight. She is in Florida. And before I hand celebrations over to Hene Moana Baker, who will officially launch Sarah Jane Barnett's spectacular second book, Work, I will say a few words from Chloe. Chloe says, I'm very sorry I can't be with you tonight to help Sarah celebrate the launch of Work. This one is a particularly difficult one to miss because Sarah is such a dear friend, and I've witnessed up close how much time, energy, and heart has gone into making this book. Additionally, tonight is also a big night for Hue & Cry Press, because Work, which is Sarah's second book after her New Zealand Post Book Awards nomination for A Man Runs Into a Woman, is our first second book. So for me, the publication of Work also feels like a coming of age of sorts for Hue & Cry Press. I only have a few thank yous before Sarah, Hene Moana, and guests take over. Firstly, thank you to Sarah for the years of poems you've published with us in Hue & Cry Journal, and for trusting us with your first book and now your second. I'm constantly impressed by how much you're willing to push the boundaries between poetry and fiction, and I'm always bowled over by the depth of feeling and humanness in your writing. I'm excited that this book exists, and I have no doubt it'll find many intrigued and captivated readers. Secondly, thank you to Amy Brown, whose generosity, enthusiasm, and edits helped me make Work its best possible version of itself. I'm sure Sarah would agree with me here. And Hue & Cry Press simply wouldn't be Hue & Cry Press without the friendship of designers Duncan Forbes and Elena Hamilton. Once again, Duncan has given us a book of stunning and sensitive design, so thank you, Duncan. Lastly, thank you to Vic Books for hosting and for their support and enthusiasm for independent publishing, to Creative New Zealand for helping to fund this book, and to the extended Hue & Cry Press family for making long-distance publishing possible. Again, I'm sorry I can't be here, but I hope you all have fun. And please make sure Sarah's drink is constantly topped up. Oh, and buy the book as well. And now I will hand things over to Emeritus Professor, Hollywood starlet, Eastern Bay of Plenty woodchopping champion, and wife of Lucy Lawless, Hene Moana Baker.
That was supposed to be a joke. Tēnā tātou katoa. Nau mai, haere mai, koutou ko tau mai, ki te whakanui te wahine nei, ko Sarah. Me tōna mahi hou, ko mahi. Did you know that was the Māori translation? Yeah. So welcome to all of us here who are present tonight to celebrate this awesome woman and her new work. Work. I've had a hard time deciding, to be honest, how I'm going to launch this book without just standing up here going, and listen to this, and listen to this, like just reading excerpt after excerpt, because it's amazing. So bear in mind that all of the things that I'm about to say and point you towards are, of course, so much more powerfully said between these beautiful covers. That said, however, I will do a bit of quoting because it's just too good not to. When Sarah was speaking to me about the characters that populate these superb long-form poems. She said, "The people in work are all me and mine, and also none of them is me." So this isn't an unusual thing for a writer to say, but for me it speaks to what I'd probably call a core value of Sarah's writing, which is a sharp curiosity about and a deep regard for other human beings. Each of the characters, with their unique vigour and valency, is drawn so vividly here and with so much economy. And always there's the body. Biology is everywhere and wonderful in Sarah's work. The body's internalities, as evoked by its own and the world's externalities. Its hands, lips, pinknesses, its faint tan lines, its fibre board and ranch sliders. I've never read the body and all its slippery valves and caves so powerfully and beautifully evoked as in this book. All of the really, really flash things that I'm saying, by the way, just know that those are quotes. I'm making myself sound real good here. The Small Boy in Glaciers, which is one of the long poems here, is described as playing with the webbing between his mother's fingers. His shoulders roll up with the cold. He is a landslip of limbs. The woman, a glaciologist, stands on the ice, watching the winch slide the core into the light. At the same time, she's remembering the aches in her body after she gave birth to her son, and how her breasts, quote, leaked a constant stream over onto the flaccid mound of her stomach. She is a wintered forest. She is extensive and stable. I'm going to just read a little bit here. She is a wintered forest. She is extensive, stable. She is melt, the parent rock. She is saturated, volcanic. She zips up her clean suit and pulls on a pair of latex gloves. Her colleague has already transferred today's ice core from the freezer to the clean room. In Running With My Father, a woman runs with hunter's legs, a web of tendons. Her joints are data points in a dialogue of impact and velocity. And in the book's first poem, In the Isle of the New World, New Zealand supermarket, the translator from Addis Ababa, who's here for refuge, encounters the "why don't you just go home" style of racism, which is one of our least endearing national traits, I think. And he receives it in his body, again, as much as his heart and his mind. So I'm just going to read another little excerpt. Last week, a woman brought bright pink buns filled with sweet cream. People had clapped. An old man is touching the tea. His hand lifts one box, then another, holding each like a cubed puzzle. I see his arm tremble. "Go home," he says, his head still down. I look over my shoulder. Me? Hot needles prick into my face, my throat thick and salty. The man turns to face me. "Go back home," he says. "We don't need you here." His eyes are liquid and raw. Sun spots blotch his cheeks. For a moment I look back. "Isn't this home?" I say. This is not a book where the same characters move in obvious or deliberate ways through the different stories or poems, you know, like some of those collected works of collective fiction where the same people turn up in different stories, or some of the films that do that too. But one of the delights of reading this book has been noticing the subtle ways that the characters and creatures in one poem sometimes become kind of ghost presences or figments or wraiths and memories in others, like they're present but present in shadow. The Woman Who Married a Bear is a poem in which an asexual woman hunts a black bear on a New Zealand sheep station. In Running With My Father, the running woman is, quote, "an animal circling the hollows of my body. Deep grunts rise up from my pelvis to my throat." She is also a sled dog pulling my body behind me, and that dog evokes the ice and snow of glaciers. So there's beautiful echoes through the whole piece, through the whole book. None of it is accidental, obviously. And the resulting whole goes beyond metaphor, beyond autobiography, into the earth and the city, into the sinew and the slicing winter light. For this and many other reasons, each of the poems in this collection, I believe, rewards a reader with the power of an entire novel, or even a full-length film. It's like the book as a whole is a film festival, where all the directors are your favourite directors, and every scene and shot is a marvellous magnification or a breathtaking ice scape, or a tiny camera travelling the body's arteries. I'm going to finish with a favourite moment in the book. The woman in glaciers is on her way to pick up her son from daycare, and she's imagining how he will jump out when he sees her, his tiny form crumpling forward with excitement. So just listen to this last piece. He'll jump out, his tiny form crumpling forward with excitement. She can't help but imagine him as a young man. She sees her son on a street corner. He is 18. It's a few months after he's moved out. He's talking with a man and a woman, hands slack in his pockets. The day is warm. He is easy with himself, almost languid, like a photograph of herself in her 20s. He raises one lean arm and lets it fall around the other young man's shoulder. He is continuous, fluid. His laughter, those precious drops. So thanks, Sarah, for this book and many more to come. Thank you.
Ghosts. Longyearbyen, 10:13 a.m., 20th of January, 2035. Diane sleeps. The rain comes in like heels falling on a stone floor. Her body, almost silent, a private exhale. Fowler puts on his thick red snow jacket and hat. The air flaps catch in his beard. Outside, Longyearbyen rests in the valley. The sun has touched the peak of the A-frame, but the mountain is still dark behind. Ice blue, scrubbed black. He gets in his pickup and drives slowly through the snowy streets, past the Svalbard church, and down the long road to the airstrip where a helicopter waits for him, the hangar frozen to the ground, the runway insulated against melt.
Why talk now?
It's our come to Jesus.
How about when people aren't starving?
We use a public policy definition. They're not starving yet.
I think the citizens of Turkey would disagree.
You're dodging. On the flight last night?
Yes.
And in the kitchen?
I know.
It's hard for me too. This involves us both.
Fowler, I know.
The chopper banks east. The sun floats a few degrees above the horizon. It's the end of a dark winter, so it won't rise any further, hovering there like an awkward friend, the atmosphere bending its rays to a peach fade on the snowscape. Fowler shuffles his papers, those long dead trees. The vault's too cold for his tablet. Even an ink pen will freeze. He reads his notes, his last visit 4 months ago to deliver packets of regenerated seeds. Grown in thin plastic homes, their tiny green nibs, their roots wreathed in cotton fibres. Canadian mustard seeds, he remembers them, and castor beans. The oily seeds that can only survive a decade, even at minus 20. At the window extends the last juncture of land before the far north, the top of the world, the endless white.
I see children who die in car crashes.
Everything has risk. Your mother killed herself. That's genetic.
Don't be an asshole.
I'm being serious.
I have other kids to queue for. You know Pete's won't let me operate past the second trimester. I won't miss out.
What about me?
Give me your hand.
I have this idea of us, Diane. I see swing sets. I have names.
Feel my heartbeat?
Your histological foundation.
It's a fragile muscle.
Embryonic, protective, spermatophyte, ripened ovule, she and he bent together to complete the process. Zygote, integuments, irregularities, in her primitive places, her abnormal mosses, his dominating niches. Anything can be sown. His hand on her shoulder, it rests like a bat. Fowler hauls his snow ski over the bridge and undercover. Blue arctic light skims the vault, a wedge of stone rising from the mountain. A glass and steel sculpture shines above the entrance. He's back. A journalist once described the landscape as godforsaken. Fowler unzips his glove and places one palm against the sensor. It burns orange. For a moment he looks out over the whiteness. That journo was an idiot. Down the long corridor the lights flicker on. Familiar ducts and refrigeration piping hang from the ceiling. He walks the sloped tunnel deep into the rock. Beyond the committee's scenarios, beyond the sun's pale course, beyond sound. Fowler thinks of Diane. He thinks of their flight tomorrow back to Tennessee. He thinks of her generous body. He thinks of the vault under a nuclear strike. He thinks of the tiny round of their child that he wrapped in newspaper and buried in the garden. He thinks of Iraq and Afghanistan, the seed banks that war wiped out, of that bank in the Philippines, flooded by a typhoon. He thinks of when he first met Diane. She'd led the UN volunteers boxing seeds for repletion. Her red hair and cheeks, her echoing laughter. Did she love him then? Fowler reaches the end of the corridor. It opens up like blown glass.
Tomorrow?
I'm getting the PI178383.
Your favourite, the ugly wheat.
It's beautiful. Genetic heirloom. They'll be able to replant even in salinated soil. We can make a beautiful child.
Are we still talking?
She'd have my hair, black and straight.
Forlorn then.
Graceful. Your eyes. My height.
My mother always hated kids. She'd say, the better as they get older, but as a rule, I still hate them. Sorry, that's not really funny. I won't come. The vault's your baby. I never got used to the place.
Those were a good 3 months. You know, it's not your work or your mother.
It's always my mother.
Seriously, Diane.
It's easy for you to sit beside me, to drink coffee in a waiting room.
You really think that?
The medical term is voluntary death. Did you know that?
I didn't know.
As though it's a spontaneous choice, like going night swimming. The child swims out of my body.
In the bathroom, she is halved. By the mirror, she walks. The linoleum corridor lies down under a white sheet. Light plays over the ceiling. She remembers each tile, their limits. The doctors slide into her bright abdomen.